The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
I think I know most of you, but just in case, my name is Andrea Fella. And tonight I'd like to talk about some qualities of mind that get in the way of our meditation practice and of our ability to be mindful. Those states called the hindrances. The hindrances consist of five really common ways, very common states of mind that obstruct or hinder our practice. And these five states are sensual desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, which is essentially sleepiness and dullness, restlessness and remorse, and doubt. I talked quite a bit about doubt last week in the context of, position to the topic of faith. So I won't spend as much time on doubt this evening, but I'd like to talk about the hindrances as a whole and about each of them individually. The Buddha often described these hindrances as states of mind that hinder our ability to concentrate, our ability to settle and collect the mind. And they're most often described as hindrances to concentration in the Buddhist texts. But they also not only hinder our ability to be concentrated, they also get in the way of a general feeling of happiness and well-being. These states can get in the way of our just feeling good in our lives. In one sutta, the Buddha described the hindrances or related the hindrances in an analogy to a banyan tree, which is a kind of a tree that begins its life as a seedling up in the crevice of another tree. And in that crevice, it sends out these roots, and the roots then go down to the ground and begin to, as they touch the ground and hit the ground, then they begin to thicken and start surrounding the tree. So the banyan tree uses another tree to support itself in order to grow. And in that process of sending out those roots and creating a structure around the other tree, it strangles and kills the tree that it used to start its life on. So they're sometimes called strangler figs. They're a fig tree, and they're sometimes called strangler figs because they essentially strangle the tree that they began their life on. And in a similar way, if we don't see and understand the hindrances, they encircle our mind. It's like they thicken into the structure in our minds, and they sap the strength from the beautiful qualities that are more naturally present if the hindrances are not there. So when we experience the hindrances, there's often a feeling of something being wrong, something being off. There's a feeling of conflict. There's a feeling of dissatisfaction, a feeling of restlessness, a feeling of just things not being right, a feeling of agitation. And they leave us feeling struggling and unhappy a lot of the time. They are a form of suffering, of dukkha. The hindrances obscure our ability to see clearly. And there's an analogy that the Buddha used in describing the hindrances, where he talked about a bowl of water, basically. He described each of the hindrances in terms of how different ways in which things impact the bowl of water and its ability to reflect our face. So, for instance, you know, I think they used water as a kind of a reflection device to be able to look at themselves. And he likened sense desire, the first hindrance, to a bowl of water that has dye in it, so different colors. And in that reflection, you can kind of see yourself, you can kind of see your face, but it's got all these different colors on it. So you're not really seeing a true reflection of your face. So in a similar way, sense desire kind of puts glasses, or I like to think of it as this as the rose-colored glasses analogy, because it does tend to, we tend to think that whatever we want will make us happy. That's what sense desire is about. That when we want something, we think it will make us happy. And we're not seeing clearly the nature of happiness and the nature of what can make us happy. And I'll talk about each of these more as we go on. The second ill will is likened in that bowl of water as if the water were boiling. So the surface is not, you can't really see anything on the surface of the water when the water's boiling. It doesn't reflect much at all. It's just got all of the bubbles popping on the surface. So you're not able to really see much. And in a state of ill will, that's the way we are. We're not really able to see much at all. We are just consumed by our anger. And this analogy also brings in this sense of heat that comes with ill will and anger. The third, sloth and torpor, the analogy for that with respect to this bowl of reflecting water is that it is like the water is covered with algae. So you can't see because the surface is coated with this slime and green growth. So again, we're not able to see. The clarity, the reflecting is covered. And that's actually another definition or another way in which the term for hindrance, the Pali term for hindrance is nivarana, and it is sometimes translated as covering, as states that cover our ability to see clearly. So it's not so much that they're they don't take over in the way that a strangler fig takes over and actually kills what's underneath it. Rather, they cover it so thoroughly that we can't really see what's underneath it. And that's the way the algae is on top of the water. We can't see what's underneath it. And again, the sloth and torpor refers to dullness, sleepiness. And again, I like this image because it calls to mind the stagnation of the water that's necessary to grow the algae. And a stagnant mind is one that is dull and sleepy. Restlessness and worry, the analogy for that is that the bowl of water has wind blowing across it so that the surface is ruffled and we can't see clearly our reflection. The fifth, doubt, in that bowl of water is clouded by mud. It's stirred up and clouded by mud that's all through it, so you can't see the reflection in the water. So an aspect of this analogy that I like is that it points out that these are obstructions that prevent us from seeing clearly. It's not that the water itself is a problem. The water itself can reflect in each of these if we allow the dye to settle or if we allow the mud to settle, then we can see the reflection. If we move the algae from the side, we can see the reflection. So that The hindrances are things that color our perception or make it difficult for us to see clearly. But as in this analogy, the eye is seeing clearly. It's just that the water is covered or filled with something that makes it difficult for us to see. So it's like a lens or a filter or a perceptual thing that we're looking through that obscures things. It's not the inherent nature of the mind. And that's one of the key teachings, actually, around the hindrances, that they're not inherent in the mind. They're not... they don't have to be there. They're optional. Now, it's not easy to see that, but that's part of what I'm going to talk about this evening, how we can see that they are optional and not just a part of our minds. So cultivating the ability to recognize, work with, and let go of these hindrances goes a long way to bringing more happiness into our lives. It also supports our ability to get more concentrated. We often think about concentration as being focusing on something, staying with the breath, for instance, just coming back over and over again to the breath. And this, in fact, does support concentration. And part of the way it supports concentration is through letting go of everything that's not that one thing that we're paying attention to. So in trying to pay attention to the breath, if we notice the mind is restless and going off in every which way, we consciously try to keep bringing it back. So in this way, the cultivation of concentration supports the letting go of the hindrances. But there's also another way to cultivate concentration, and that's by studying what gets in its way, which are these hindrances. So as we study these states of mind, of sensual desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness and remorse, and doubt, so we actually bring our attention to them and observe them, they begin to not function as hindrances so much anymore, and they begin to fall away, and then the mind more naturally settles into stillness. So there's two ways to go at the concentration. But I actually feel like one of the biggest benefits of working with these hindrances is that it really supports our understanding how our own mind functions and how we get ourselves into trouble through wanting things to be other than they are. So as I mentioned a few minutes ago, these states of the hindrances are types of suffering, types of ways in which we feel dissatisfied in our lives. And with respect to suffering, the instruction that the Buddha suggests that we engage in is to understand it. Not in an intellectual way, but in an experiential way. So to understand the hindrances is the key. Understanding them, not by thinking about them, but by exploring them with mindfulness. So we gather data about these states of mind. We look at what happens to us when they come up. Not by thinking about them, but through more directly experiencing them in the body, noticing what happens to our bodies, to our minds, as they are present for us. Gathering this data, we begin to recognize what it's like when these hindrances are present, and we can begin to recognize what it's like when they're absent. This is not a small thing, actually. This is actually a really important point. recognizing with mindfulness when one of these states is not present. We begin to observe the conditions that make them come, these states come up. What kind of things bring sensual desire into our experience? What kinds of things bring ill will into our experience? We learn what kinds of things help us to let go of them. And we learn what kinds of ways in which to avoid their coming up if they're not present. All of this we can see just through observing in our own experience, in the direct experience of these states. Now, these things that I've just talked about, these are the actually the instructions that the Buddha gives around working with hindrances. He gives meditation instructions around working with these hindrances, and I'll read a bit of the section to you for one of them. I'll read it for sensual desire. Ooh, I don't know if I can read that. I will try. There being sensual desire present, a meditator understands there is sensual desire in me. So that's the recognizing the presence of the hindrance. There being no sensual desire, the meditator understands there is no sensual desire in me. So that's recognizing the absence. So recognizing presence and absence. Those are the first two instructions. Begin to recognize and get familiar with what it's like to have these states and what it's like to not have these states. The meditator also understands how there comes to be the arising of unarisen sensual desire. So the causes and conditions that create sense desire. How there comes to be the abandoning of arisen sensual desire. So what supports when sense desire is present? What supports it, us letting go of it? What supports that letting go process? And how there comes to be the future non-arising of abandoned sensual desire, which is that learning about how we can avoid these hindrances. So through the observing, and the same pattern is repeated for all of the hindrances. These are the instructions he gives. It's also really, really helpful to recognize these in these states and understand them as not helpful states of mind. That sense desire is not a helpful state of mind, that ill will is not a helpful state of mind, that essentially they're unskillful. They don't support the settling of the mind. They don't support our happiness, actually. They run counter to our own happiness. Now, this last aspect can be a little bit challenging to actually see, because the hindrances themselves, when we're in the state of the hindrances, they kind of blind us to the fact that they are hindrances. When we're in a state of sense desire, we really believe that that thing that we want will make us happy. And we don't see that it's only a transient kind of happiness, that it's not a true kind of happiness. It's hard to understand when we're worried about something that the worry itself is contributing to our unhappiness. Because we really think that in that worry, that something about that worry will solve our problem. That it's really important to worry about that thing. So the hindrances themselves, when we're in that state, they kind of blind us to the fact that they are in the way of our happiness. Because we are so habituated to finding happiness or thinking that we can find happiness through controlling the world, through manipulating how our environment is. Now, it's not to say that there's no happiness through some kind of getting things. There is a sort of a happiness there. When we get something that we want, there's a moment of feeling like we've accomplished something, like, yes, things are right for now. And that's a very small moment of happiness. But we think, mistakenly think, that that's the best happiness that there is, if we could only line up our lives to have one moment of that kind of happiness after another. And we think that's the best kind of happiness there would be, is that arrangement of our environment and our lives to have those little moments of happiness one after another. This view of the world, This way that we perceive things, doesn't understand that there's a deeper kind of happiness that comes from letting go of trying to manipulate the world. It's actually a deeper, more lasting kind of happiness that comes from letting go as opposed to holding on. There's an analogy that comes from my background in mathematics. I used to be a mathematician. And in the computer science field, there's a way in which if you're trying to find the highest point on a graph, this is called a hill climbing algorithm. You keep going up, you keep going up and comparing, well, is this point higher than the last point? And you get to the top of the hill, and you think, okay, yep, that's the highest point. But you can't just stop there in this search, because if you go down, there may yet later be a higher point somewhere else in the field that you're looking in. So, you go up to a point, to a hill, at the top of a hill, and you think that's the best it is. And that lower hill is kind of where we are with the way we normally try to find happiness. And we think, because we have to go down from there to find anything better, that, well, we found the best there is. But we have to, in this letting go, we have to let go of our belief that this is the best it can be. And the practice, as we engage in it, begins to show us the letting go. As we begin to have tastes of that letting go of these states, we begin to see that there is a different kind of happiness, this happiness of letting go. So observing the hindrances, observing these states of mind, is the key to understanding them. And one wonderful thing about mindfulness is that we can be mindful of anything. Even these so-called hindrances that obstruct and or obscure our clear seeing can be taken as subjects of our mindful attention. And when we are mindful of them, they no longer function as hindrances. It's like the bringing our attention to these states of mind converts them from being hindrances into the path itself, into the process we use to wake up. There's a beautiful poem that celebrates this. I'm sure many of you have heard this poem. It's a kind of a famous poem. It's by Rumi, and it's called The Guest House. This being human is a guest house. Every morning a new arrival, a joy, a depression, a meanness. Some momentary awareness comes as an unexpected visitor. Welcome and entertain them all, even if they are a crowd of sorrows who violently sweep your house empty of its furniture. Still, treat each guest honorably. He may be clearing you out for some new delight. The dark thought, the shame, the malice, meet them at the door laughing and invite them in. Be grateful for whatever comes, because each has been sent as a guide from beyond. And that's how these hindrances function. If we invite them in and bring our awareness to them, treat them as a guest, then they open our eyes and our hearts to a new possibility for happiness. So these states, these hindrances, are not inherent in the mind, as I said before. They can be released. So I'd like to talk about each one of these states and talk a little bit about working with them with mindfulness. So sensual desire. This is about being attached to things we like and want. And the feeling, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, that our happiness is dependent on arranging our lives to have things that we like and want around us. Now, it's not that having lovely things around us is a problem. It's the needing things to be that way. That's the issue. We expect these lovely things to stay, and we suffer when we lose them. Therein lies the problem, that we cling to these lovely things. We cling to sense desire. It's not the sensual pleasure itself that is a problem. It is the needing it to be a certain way. So it's the feeling, the sense desire, the desire aspect is the feeling of being pulled towards something with the feeling that it will somehow satisfy us, will somehow make us happy. It might be another person, it might be some object like a car or a beautiful vase that you've seen, or it might be something more subtle like a wanting to know something or a wanting to experience something. Like you might have heard about the blissful states of concentration that can result in these lovely feelings in your body. And there might be a desire to feel that. So that's a little more subtle version of sense desire. But actually, when I look at it, when I look at sense desire, there's sometimes we think of the things that we want. Like we see something and it's so beautiful, we're focused out on that thing and we think that, well, that thing is what I want. But actually what we want, if we actually look at what's going on, what we actually want is some idea about how that thing will make us happy. It's not the thing itself. It's an idea of the thing and how it will make us happy. It's kind of joined together. In the sense desire, that what we want is a belief, that there's a belief that that thing will make us happy, and that's what we want. So in terms of observing what sense desire is about, probably the most important piece is to learn to recognize it. This was the first instruction that the Buddha gave on each hindrance. Recognize when it's present. Learn what it feels like. Learn what thoughts accompany it. Sometimes sense desire comes with thoughts about, oh, if only I could have that thing, you know, that then I would be happy. There's certain familiar thoughts that go with sense desire. And if you can begin to recognize those thoughts, it can help you to identify when it's present. In the recognizing it, one of the most powerful ways to work with it is to actually name or note or use a label in the mind, just simply naming the fact that it's present. So if you notice that sense desire is present, just simply saying to yourself, sense desire is present, just as it said in the sutta that I read, sense desire is present in me. Just recognizing that fact. This naming or noting sounds like a very small thing, but it actually is a huge shift in the mind from being caught and identified, tied up with the sense desire, and being able to observe it. So it takes us from the stance of being embedded and entwined with it to being separated from it and able to actually say, yes, that state is present. And initially, perhaps, it doesn't seem like a big deal. But that is the beginning of the process by which it can let go. There's actually scientific evidence to support the fact that this naming or noting helps us to let go of difficult states. There was a scientific study that talked about, I think it was particularly around anger and difficult emotions, but that if people labeled or noted, used that noting type of practice around an emotion, it engaged a different part of the brain. That the emotion was kind of more in the deeper part of the brain, perhaps in the reptilian brain, where some of these hindrances operate, you know, in that place that just wants to get food and wants to be comfortable, you know, that part of the brain that is common to all beings. And when we engage the naming or noting part of the brain, it said it engaged the higher brain, and that it freed the kind of cycling in the lower part of the brain, and it allowed that to diminish. So this naming or noting technique is very, very powerful. I like it when science confirms some of these things. So recognizing it, learning, beginning to recognize what sense desire feels like. Recognizing its absence. Again, getting to know what it's like when it's not there. The Buddha said that freedom from sensual desire is like being released from debt. If we take out a loan thinking we'll get something that we like, We'll get some beautiful thing. And yet, when we buy that thing on loan, we don't own it free and clear. There's still something we have to pay back. And that's the way sense desire is, that essentially we're holding on to that thing. It's not just free and clear in our experience. It's something we're grasping to hold on to. And if you, in observing your sense desire, if paying attention to sense desire, you see it disappear, you see it actually end, it can feel like being released from a vice grip. So paying attention with mindfulness is probably it is the strongest force that can combat these hindrances. So paying attention to the sense desire itself. Typically, again, when we're engaged in sense desire, we're engaged out. Our attention is focused out on the thing that we want. Whether it's a person, a beautiful painting, or just a nice food, we're focused out on that thing. And what the practice of mindfulness asks us to do is to withdraw our attention from the thing that we want and turn our attention to what it is to be wanting. So turning our attention back to what does it feel like to be a human being that wants something? This is counterintuitive. Because we're so focused on getting things and fixing things in the world, we don't often turn back and look at what does it actually feel like? Putting our attention in our experience. A great place to do this is in the body. What does the body feel like when it wants something? Often I find it feeling like I'm being pulled towards that thing, almost as if it's a magnet pulling me. Attending to the body is very helpful with all of the hindrances. If you're paying attention, turning your attention to what each of these states feels like, bringing attention to the body is one of the most supportive ways to work with these hindrances, because it helps to cut any story that's going on, any stream of thoughts that's going on. All of these hindrances have some kind of thought often associated with them. In the case of sense desire, it's this story around, well, if only I can get this thing, then I'll be happy, even if it's just for now, even if it's just for a moment. So bringing our attention to the body helps to cut that movement of thinking. It cuts that movement of that spiral of thinking that tends to just keep feeding the sense desire. So bringing our attention with mindfulness to this state, we'll start to notice things about it. We'll start to notice what causes it. What supports its going away. And mindfulness itself is probably one of the biggest supports to allow us to let go of these hindrances. Sometimes if we just notice them and name them, as I was saying, that simple naming itself allows them to dissipate. Sometimes we have to work a little harder. Sometimes if we have hindrances that really grab us, we really, really feel a strong tension, then we have to hang out with it a little bit longer. And we may want to apply an antidote. And each of these hindrances has their own antidote. And the antidote for sense desire is to consciously pay attention to the unattractive aspects of what we're drawn to. So, for instance, if you really want that new Prius, you know, there's some good things about a Prius, you know, and that's what we're drawn to with the sense desire. We're drawn to the fact that it's going to give us the great gas mileage, you know, that it's going to, we're going to be able to not spend as much money on gas. So those are some good things about the Prius. But if you're finding that you're caught by this, and perhaps you actually can't afford to buy the Prius right now, then reflecting on some of the aspects of the unattractive aspects of that object can help to cut that desire. For instance, reflecting on the fact that it costs this amount of money and that that's not possible right now. So turning the attention more to the unattractive aspects of the object. I don't actually use that very often with sense desire. Mostly I use mindfulness. I find mindfulness to be the most skillful way for me to work with sense desire. The second hindrance, ill will, is that idea that our happiness depends on getting rid of things. So it's similar to sense desire in that it's, again, about manipulating our environment. We want to get rid of things that we don't like. We harbor ill will towards people that people and things that get in the way of things that we want. Or we harbor ill will towards people and things that we just don't like. So again, we're outwardly focused with ill will. We tend to have our attention out on the thing itself. And the movement is towards how can I arrange the environment so that this thing will not be here. And what the movement in bringing attention to ill will is that same movement of turning back to what does it feel like to be a human being feeling this? What does that feel like? Now, this doesn't mean that we shouldn't work. This is not a kind of a passivity. Now, often I think people hear this teaching about ill will and think, well, I'm not supposed to want to change anything in my environment. And that's not what this is about. It's more about letting go of the hostility and the aversion around things being the way they are. Not that we can't work to change things, but can we let go of the hatred, the hostility around the wanting to change them? It's possible to change things and to aspire to change things without hating the thing that we're changing. It can be challenging, but it is possible. So learning to recognize ill will. Again, ill will, it has a couple of different flavors for us. There can be a flavor of a feeling of pulling away when there's something that we don't like. There can be a kind of a feeling of revulsion, of disgust from that thing. And so that's a kind of a pulling inwards. Or there can be a kind of a lashing out, almost an angry movement. So, roughly those two movements with ill will, a kind of a recoiling and a lashing out. So again, recognizing them, learning what it feels like. With each of these hindrances, there's probably one or two of them that are more familiar for you than the others. And it's really helpful to get to know particularly those hindrances that are your favorites. For me, this one is my favorite. It is my pattern is around aversion, around dislike. And so what we do with this is get to know it really well. Gill sometimes uses the term become a connoisseur of the hindrance, particularly the ones that are really familiar to you. Get to know them really well. That getting to know them really well is that understanding. As we understand these hindrances, there's a kind of a magic power that mindfulness has in that understanding. The hindrances begin to shift and change. They no longer run our lives in the same way. So recognizing ill will, what does it feel like? Turning the attention back. Now, ill will generally feels unpleasant. It has an unpleasant quality to it. There's a lot of different flavors to it. And sometimes hearing the names of some of these can help to help us recognize them. So here's some of the range for ill will. Anger, bitterness, resentment, hostility, dislike, rage, irritation, annoyance, hatred, distrust, cruelty, discontent, frustration, aversion, dissatisfaction, contempt, disdain. So getting to know these states, recognizing them when they're present, and again, using that noting, if possible, as a very powerful tool to working with these states. And in that noting, seeing if you can recognize a little bit of shift that happens. when you can use the noting, when you can actually identify and just say, yes, anger is present for me, fear is present for me, ill will is present in me, there's a little bit of engagement with that other part of our brain. And if you can connect to that part of the brain that is noting, that's knowing what's happening, there's a little bit of space, a feeling of a little bit of space around that hindrance. So seeing if you can connect with that feeling of a little bit of space. And this, again, points to the recognizing when the state is absent. So when is ill will not present? So again, using the same tools that I described around sense desire for ill will, using mindfulness, withdrawing our attention from the experience that we dislike, turning our attention to the experience in the, particularly in the body. Noticing if there's any moods or emotions that frequently accompany ill will. Does the mind get into a kind of a general state of dislike? I've noticed this in my own experience of aversion. That if I get into a state of aversion, it's like everything becomes something that I'm averse to. I was doing walking meditation and I was finding I often got averse in walking meditation on retreats. And I really noticed how strong the aversion was when I looked across the room and I saw somebody's shoes and just felt this huge upwelling of aversion at somebody's shoes. It's like, wow, okay, this is a kind of a generalized state of aversion. Clearly, it's not the shoes that I'm averse to. And so, you know, beginning to explore, what is this state? So the antidote for aversion and ill will is to cultivate loving kindness. Now this one, for somebody who is really aversive, as I am, this can be challenging. So this antidote is one that took me a long time to be able to even use because I found it so hard to even connect with the feeling of loving kindness. But it is a very powerful antidote, and it is something that is worth cultivating, particularly if you find yourself overwhelmed by aversion. Seeing if you can connect a little bit with this quality of loving kindness. So looking at the beautiful side also of what you are averse to, seeing if you can find some good in that thing that you are averse to. And that thing, that seeing the good in something is the seed or the root of that feeling of loving kindness. So the third, sloth and torpor. This is related to the energy. Both actually sloth and torpor and restlessness are related to the energy level in our practice. So sloth and torpor has to do with the not having a lot of energy to practice. And restlessness is often related to having too much energy to practice. And too much, we're kind of agitated. So the sloth refers to a kind of a dullness of mind, and the torpor to actual sleepiness. So when these states of mind are present, it's kind of hard to arouse the energy to even engage in practice. In sloth, the mind feels heavy, thick, kind of foggy, unworkable. In sleepiness, the mind can go into a kind of a pleasant, dreamlike state. So again, recognize it is the key. This is the key for all of these hindrances. Recognize it. Can you name it? Can you note it? Fogginess, dullness, heaviness, sleepiness. With sleepiness, though, sometimes we do have to recognize and appreciate the fact that we might need sleep. We are a sleep-deprived culture. So that's something, you know, to recognize, to pay attention to. If you're often sleepy in your meditation, you might look at whether you need some sleep. But often sleepiness also comes, people sometimes have a habit of kind of going to sleep if they want to avoid something that's going on in their experience. You know, that's a habit for some people, that a kind of a shutting down to something difficult can result in a feeling of sleepiness. So if you know that you have had enough sleep, you might notice whether this is a pattern that you have. So there's lots of advice for working with sleepiness. Opening your eyes, standing up, rubbing your limbs, pinching your ears. There's lots of things that you can do to help with sleepiness. Standing up, I think I said that. But another way to work with sleepiness is to actually see if you can pay attention to it. Recognize it. Notice it. What does it feel like to be sleepy? I found for myself that in paying attention to sleepiness, that if I'm resisting sleepiness, if I think it's not supposed to be there because I'm meditating, then the sleepiness feels really unpleasant. But if I stop resisting sleepiness and actually allow that feeling to be there and just engage with it with mindfulness, it actually feels pretty good. It's a pleasant experience, sleepiness. And so if you can turn your mindful attention to it without resistance, it can actually be fun to pay attention to. I had an experience of this on one retreat where I found that I was really sleepy, and so I just kind of watched it. And I think is where I learned that the resistance was not helpful. So I just watched the sleepiness descend, and I should just feel it, and the body would just get kind of relaxed and really pleasant, and the mind kind of started to go into this nice buzzy state. And then I felt myself just beginning to drop. And in that dropping, I could kind of straighten up my posture a little bit, and that gave me a little bit of a burst of energy, and then I could just do it all over again. And it was fun. I mean, I was kind of like being on a roller coaster, you know? Just like I'd get this really great feeling, and then I'd drop, and then, okay, do it again. And just I just did it over and over again. Somebody asked me once if that was cheating. No. You're actually using mindfulness to pay attention to what's happening. That cultivates awareness. We can't always be bright and 100% energetic. So we need to learn how to apply our energy when our energy is low. So it's a skill that we can learn. To pay attention. How can we pay attention when our energy is low? Making the best effort that you can given the circumstances. The Buddha, in terms of antidote for sloth and torpor, the Buddha recommended contemplating death. That reminding yourself that you don't have a lot of time to practice. And that sometimes if you reflect on the fact that you may die, that you will die, that you don't know when you will die, that can bring some energy. It can elevate the energy. The next one is restlessness and remorse. And again, related to the energy. So an excess of energy, which makes it difficult for the mind to settle. And this can be restlessness of mind or body. Restlessness of body feels like, you know, the body just got so much energy, it's so hard to sit still. It's a physical feeling of like jumping beans or, you know, just like this a feeling of the body not able to sit still. With the mind being restless, the mind feels like it's just jumping about all over the place. So it's not settled. It's not calm. The remorse aspect of it has to do with unsettledness caused by regret, either of an action taken that we regretted, or perhaps an action not taken. And the mind tends to play over and over again what I should have done, what I could have done. Working with these states, again, learning to recognize them. When is restlessness present? The physical version of restlessness is usually pretty easy to recognize. The body just feels really like you want to jump out of your skin. For this, I find it really helpful to allow the mindfulness of the body experience to be really wide, like almost allow the restlessness to get as big as it wants to take up the whole room, and think of the attention being as big as the whole room. That, for me, has been very helpful, as opposed to trying to really zero in or focus in on a place in the body. That just agitates the mind more to try to contain the restlessness in a particular part of the body. So seeing if you can let the restlessness expand, I found that helpful. Just almost that. Just let it get as big as it wants to, and let the awareness get as big as it wants to. The mental kind of restlessness often manifests as a lot of thinking. There's in this kind of situation, there's something fueling the thought, some kind of emotion, something underneath. So it can be helpful to check in and see, is there something going on underneath that's fueling this mind that's just not able to settle down? It may be a surprise if you actually do that. Sometimes I find just kind of asking, is there something else going on here, can help to uncover what might be fueling that restlessness underneath. I had an example of this one time when I was driving, and the mind was just spinning out of control. And I did this, you know, well, what else? What is going on here? I tried for a while to just come back and pay attention to my hands on the steering wheel and just being with the driving, but the mind just kept spinning out. And finally, I just stopped myself and said, well, what? Is there something else going on here? And what I discovered was that I was happy. And the spinning was about how to keep this happiness going. So it took me by surprise, actually. I mean, the mind was in such an unpleasant state, I had completely missed the fact that I was happy. So seeing if you can connect with what's underneath. Again, recognizing when it's not present, very powerful. The fifth is doubt, and since I did talk about doubt last week, I will only just say a word or two, that it's basically that state of mind in which we get stuck when we're not sure which way to go. In doubt, our practice kind of comes to a halt. We get so hung up in our thoughts about what we should do or what we shouldn't do. This doubt is referring to the doubt around practice. Doubt around the teachings, doubt around the teachers, doubt around our ability to do it. And it's often in the thinking process. So learning to recognize the thought patterns around doubt and being willing to work with it is the key. Recognizing that doubt is present is probably the biggest support for working with doubt. Often we feel like we have to get rid of the hindrances in order to practice. But wanting to get rid of them is another form of ill will. So it's another hindrance laid on top of these hindrances. We can be mindful of our hindrances. And as I mentioned in the guided meditation, it actually doesn't matter what we pay attention to as long as we are present in the present moment. Paying attention to these hindrances with mindfulness, we start to understand their impermanence. We start to understand the causes and conditions that lead to their arising. We see them as a process. And we start to understand how they make us suffer. These three aspects are the insights that lead us to freedom. We don't have to get rid of the hindrances in order to see these insights. We can see these insights of impermanence, of unsatisfactoriness, of ephemerality, directly right inside the hindrances themselves. So getting familiar with these states, becoming a connoisseur of them, understanding them, is our pathway towards freedom when they're present. So it's 9:01, so we need to stop. And what I thought I'd do for next week, since I talked all night tonight, is to open it up for questions. So next week, if you feel comfortable asking a question out in the room, that's fine. If you don't, then you're welcome to write a question down and come and put it in the bowl before the evening, and I'll kind of alternate from questions from the bowl and questions from the room, if there's any questions in the bowl. So thank you all for your attention.